is not a source of guidance only for the Arabian Peninsula or for the people who lived in the 7th century. It is a source of guidance for all the people till the day of Qiyamah and all parts of the world. That is the meaning of universality of the Quran. When you look at Amir al-Mu'mineen, he is a universal personality in a sense that his life and his words and the examples that he provided in the short life that he had, especially in the last 5 years of his Khilafah, these are not bound by time and space. The example of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the words of wisdom and whatever he left behind as a legacy, this has acquired its own universal form. It is applicable and a source of guidance for all the people and for all parts of the world.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Midstream.
It now can be said that Israel has fully invaded Lebanon with espionage. Over the past months, the information division of the Lebanese Internal Security Forces has been active in arresting networks dealing with the Mossad, whose number exceeded 185 as of the date of writing this report. The arrests Lebanon makes continues on an almost daily basis, to a point that this file of spy activity may require 2 years of arrests, and the number of detainees may exceed thousands. The Israeli entity has recruited a huge number of networks to an extent that the Mossad is facing a glut in its network of Lebanese spying agents. The Zionist Mossad has become so saturated with Lebanese spies that it dropped many of those moles at the first mistake they made, as per investigations with agents that the Mossad abandoned after they failed to serve on their very first case. Lebanese security sources revealed that this huge surge of spy activity increased in an unprecedented way with the onset of the economic crisis at the end of 2019. Since then, the Information Division has monitored large movements and contacts of Lebanese citizens from different sects and regions with the enemy. According to the Lebanese authorities, this surge is due to many reasons, the most prominent of which is the economic crisis affecting the lives of the Lebanese, which led to a decline in purchasing power and a decrease in the level of income, damaging the lifestyle to which they were accustomed to before the crisis. This new reality prompted many Lebanese to search for an external source of income in search of fresh US dollars, albeit through online work or in exchange for some services that can be performed to earn a quick buck. Investigations with the detainees indicate that some of them explicitly admitted that they had resorted on their own free will to the Mossad and offered espionage services by communicating with the agency via its official website. Another reason for the surge in spy activity is the lack of job opportunities in Lebanon, which prompted a large segment of young people to look for jobs outside the country. Approximately 1 million citizens uploaded their resumes online during the past 4 years in search for job opportunities without knowing the destination to which they were sent, and most of them were poured into the Mossad database in one way or another. The number of detained spies in Lebanon is considered a record compared to previous years, which many observers interpret as an Israeli exploitation of the economic crisis that has dramatically increased poverty rates in Lebanon, allowing Zionist Israel to recruit traitors at a very cheap cost. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. And 70 Israeli networks are under investigation out of thousands estimated by Lebanese security agencies to include more than 10,000 spies on Lebanese soil after Israel monitored more than a million CVs submitted by Lebanese citizens online during the past 3 years under the weight of the dire need for fresh U.S. dollar payments. The economic collapse in Lebanon has taken its toll on the country in many ways, but it seems that it is not the only reason for treason in this Middle Eastern country. Several collaborators admitted that they continued their collaboration with the Mossad out of sheer opposition to their national Lebanese resistance. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs and a political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Hijazi. Now, Lebanon has arrested 185 civilians suspected of working for the Israeli spy agency Mossad since October 2019. That's the year that our country, Lebanon, was battered by a severe economic crisis and financial tragedy. It is truly baffling for me to read these numbers, 185 in 3 years. However, are economic hardships in a country like Lebanon enough reason to betray one's country and to become a spy for the Israeli Mossad? I mean, this is an enemy that has carpet bombed their cities down to rubble many times, and they still want to be spies for Israel.
The economic factor plays a major role in the activity of the Zionist intelligence agencies and the Mossad in specific. The Mossad usually looks for opportunities within the crisis that hit Lebanon in order to recruit spies by presenting them with financial temptations. It does not necessarily have to be clear and direct implication process by the Mossad, but rather an exploitation of the financial hardship and the presentation of offers for different positions for fake companies that claim that they want to conclude work contracts with their new employees, and then they attract citizens who unknowingly apply for the job. The Mossad studies these people and learns about the nature of their work and the nature of their livelihood, and then chooses whomever they find fit to drag them into the quagmire of espionage. Then the occupation resorts to withdrawing information from these people about cases that may at first be normal issues, that do not suggest in any way to those who deal with this firm that they are dealing with the Israeli Mossad. Then the matter develops to further recruiting these people under the pretext of offering financial inducements to benefit from collecting sensitive information. At that point, people might realize that they have been implicated in a foreign intelligence service. They may not know whether it was the Mossad or another security agency. But in some cases, according to what the investigations revealed, some of the citizens discovered that they were dealing with the Zionist Mossad and decided to continue the espionage process. There is no doubt that the Zionist entity is taking advantage of the financial hardship, considering that this issue may provide a fertile ground for recruiting espionage agents. There are always those who might fall and become weak in front of financial temptations and urgent economic needs and dive further into the quagmire of espionage without realizing, in the end, the seriousness of this issue, only to discover after that they have been involved in a serious case that will take them to prison or even get them killed.
Well, Mr. Hijazi, although Lebanon remains technically in a state of war with the Zionist occupation, there has been no direct confrontation between the Lebanese side and the Zionist occupation side since the war in 2006. Nevertheless, Israel's espionage activities in Lebanon keep on just rising. They continue on and never cease. In what ways can that specifically hurt the government and the resistance as well?
The occupation is always in a state of preparation for war. It always considers the issue of collecting information part of its battle, even if the actual military battle is suspended. The occupation is aware of the sensitivity of the Lebanese reality in relation to the occupying entity. There is the force that Hezbollah has built on the political, military, and other levels, which poses a fundamental danger to the occupying entity. The occupation cannot ignore or overlook this critical matter. Israel mobilizes greater skills in order to collect information and learn about what might happen in this arena. Therefore, it may resort to methods to stir up strife and disagreements and strengthen the internal division amongst the Lebanese. This issue has direct effects on the political reality because it contributes to inflaming public opinion and inciting the Lebanese against one another. We witnessed in the investigations with some of the spies that they were receiving sums of money in exchange for their activity on social media and in exchange for articles they wrote in the press to incite resistance and create a public opinion opposing and hostile to the resistance at home. Without a doubt, this issue has an impact on the political reality and increases the complications for the Lebanese government to get out of the crisis. The resistance is also aware of the sensitivity of this matter and is aware that the occupation is seeking to build a very large bank of targets around its sites and about the method of spreading its sensitive military equipment. Consequently, the resistance resorts to various methods to reduce the size of the penetration of the Zionists into the Lebanese arena and to prevent the occupation from building this bank of targets by blocking intelligence information. Mainly because the occupation greatly benefits from this information in any future war, and transforms this information and translates it into targets that they end up striking on land, which often causes human casualties amongst civilians and destroys the Lebanese infrastructure, under the pretext that the occupation has some information about facilities that may belong to the resistance.
But how would the Lebanese resistance in Lebanon deal with such a growing challenge? I mean, let's say they were able to fixate a spy network. How would they deal with that?
The truth is that these issues are kept secret and we do not receive much information about them in the Lebanese media. However, there is clarity in the existing cooperation between the Resistance Security Service and the official Lebanese security services. There is an attempt to share information to take advantage of all the means available to the resistance in order to pursue these spying networks. There is a permanent and continuous effort to expose these networks and gather information about them in order to monitor any pathway through which the occupation can penetrate the Lebanese reality by recruiting agents, whether through the virtual space, through social media, or through the old traditional means of recruitment. The resistance is present in its capabilities and apparatuses at this level, and it cooperates with the security services in order to combat this phenomenon and pursue spying agents to block the Zionists from gathering information from the Lebanese arena, whether against the resistance or the state or other groups present operating in Lebanon. This cooperation aims to find the kind of mechanism that can mitigate the size of the Zionist penetration into the Lebanese arena.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, expert in Zionist affairs and political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very pressing matter inside Lebanon and against the Lebanese resistance. Thank you for your contribution. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking how Jenin is facing Zionist fascism.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
The closer the future Israeli government is to seeing light, the higher the level of terrorism and criminality is becoming in the occupied Palestinian territories, which would clearly outline the features of the new phase that the Palestinians are embarking on, which is filled with grim and dangerous challenges. Despite the weight of the massacre committed by the enemy last week in the Jenin camp, which caused grief and anger throughout Palestine, the resistance's insistence on clashing with the occupation and the state of popular support it enjoys, especially in the West Bank, indicate that the coming Israeli breaking waves aggression might not do more than what the first breaking waves had already done. Jenin faces Zionist fascism in this following report.
After a series of assassinations and arrests in Jenin and Nablus, the resistance in both cities is still sticking to its vow and position to continue resisting and confronting the Zionist occupation army with its incursions in the occupied areas of the West Bank. In the meantime, the resistance groups in the West Bank, especially the Jenin Brigades and the Lion's Den Battalions, are working to develop their military and security activities. Zionist media reported lately that the Palestinian fighters in the West Bank currently possess high-quality rifles, claiming that clashes that were once confined to rock-throwing have now become street gunfights. It was no coincidence that on Thursday, the 8th of December, the Palestinians bid farewell to five martyrs who were killed by the bullets of the occupation on the 35th anniversary of the outbreak of the First Palestinian Intifada. In a day burdened with sadness and anger that the occupied territories lived from north to south following the enemy's massacre in Jenin, which led to the fall of three new martyrs, Ata Shalebi, 46 years old, Tariq Dajem, 29 years old, and Sidqi Zakarne, 29 years old, during armed clashes described as the most violent this year. At the early hours of dawn on Friday, December 9, Zionist occupation patrols accompanied by huge military bulldozers stormed the city of Jenin and its camp from all entrances, occupied many buildings, and set up sniper teams on top of them after special forces had infiltrated before them. Following the raid, which the enemy claimed was aimed at arresting one of the resistance fighters involved in the booby trapping of a vehicle that exploded weeks ago and was intended to carry out a commando operation, the resistance fighters engaged in armed clashes, during which they targeted the occupation forces with heavy bullets and homemade explosive devices, according to what was announced by the Martyr Azzedine al-Qassam Brigades and the Jenin Brigade and the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, confirming that direct losses occurred among the enemy soldiers whose cries were heard by Jenin residents, while eyewitnesses confirmed the presence of Israeli ambulances at the site. The enemy's escalation of crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories comes at a time when the racist right-wing government is close to seeing light. The Jenin massacre coincided with the announcement that the Prime Minister-designate Benjamin Netanyahu had reached an agreement with the religious right-wing Shas party to include it in the coalition, in exchange for its president Aryeh Deri taking over the interior and health ministries during the first half of the new government's term and the finance ministry in the second half. Thus, the pillars of the fascist coalition are completed, after Netanyahu also reached an agreement with the far-right religious Zionism party that its leader Bezalel Smotrich would assume the Ministry of Finance for a period of 2 years. This formation reinforces expectations that the occupied territories will witness an explosion that seems inevitable, in light of head of the Otzma Yehudit party, Itamar Ben-Gvir, and Bezalel Smotrich taking over the departments and ministries directly related to the Palestinians.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Jenin camp is Mr. Mohammad Jradat, political commentator and author. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Mohammad. Now, it was no coincidence that last Thursday the Palestinians actually bid farewell to five martyrs who were killed by the bullets of the Zionist occupation, which coincided with the 35th anniversary of the First Intifada in occupied Palestine. What are the indications of such a fierce confrontation 35 years later?
Assalamu alaikum, yaatikum al-afiyah.
Peace be upon you. These brutal attacks launched by the Israeli occupation on Jenin have gone beyond last week to the present day. Tonight, for example, more martyrs fell successively, the last of which was the 15-year-old child martyr, Jana Zakarni, who was killed by the occupier with seven bullets while she was on the roof of her house during an attack on the Bayadir area in the city of Jenin. This brutal attack, which coincided with the 35th anniversary of the First Intifada, reflects Israel's insistence on eliminating the Palestinian people on the one hand humiliating them, bringing them to their knees, and cauterizing their consciousness. On the other hand, the Palestinian people, through their available primitive capabilities, spare no effort in inflicting losses to the ranks of the Zionist enemy. On the other hand, the Palestinian people, through their available primitive capabilities, spare no effort in inflicting losses to the ranks of the Zionist enemy. Therefore, with every incursion into Jenin, in particular, and into Nablus, the resistance fighters who are armed with simple automatic rifles and young men carrying their stones are pouring into the streets and into the alleys to confront this fortified Israeli war mechanism, which is protected by drones and helicopters that storm the Palestinian areas to attack them and inflict as many losses as possible. Jenin, a small city in the north of the West Bank, presented more than 80 martyrs during these months. But it is a city in which the Jenin Brigade and young men from the Lions Brigades and Al-Quds Brigades took it upon themselves to restore the glow of resistance in the northern West Bank. Dozens of heroes emerged from among them who rubbed the nose of this occupier with dirt from time to time. This confrontation continues to this day. Today there was a security incident between the Israeli security services and the Jenin battalion, and so the series of confrontation continues until Allah wishes otherwise.
Mr. Muhammad, the enemy's escalation comes at a time when the racist right-wing government led by Benjamin Netanyahu is being prepared to be launched in the Zionist entity. We have seen Netanyahu doing agreements with the right-wing Shas party, the head of the party, Aryeh Deri, and also with other fascist coalition members. How will this be reflected on the Palestinian natives, especially in besieged Jenin right now?
The Shas party, the Jewish Tzatura party, and the Likud party are normal parties in the frequent right-wing fascist Zionist governments. What is new in this brutal coalition formation is the entry of the religious Zionist party with 14 seats in the Zionist Knesset. This development is the master of the situation. For Deri, the leader of Chas, to take over the Ministry of Health and Finance, who was previously arrested several times on the charges of corruption, theft and embezzlement, as are most of the leaders of Chas and Yehudi Tzatura, have been arrested in connection with thefts. It is surprising and strange that Itamar Ben-Gavir and Smotrich became in the first term in charge of the Ministry of Finance and the Civil Judiciary in the West Bank. We are talking about the West Bank security as seen inside the Israeli Ministry of War. Ben-Gavir takes over the Ministry of National Security with an expansion of powers. This very huge development is the master of the situation now, so that Netanyahu, although he appears as a swollen peacock, has become a hostage and captive in the hands of those whom the Israeli Knesset has never included. In 1984, Kahana entered the Knesset and was expelled by Shamir and the Knesset members at the time. But today we see Smotrich and Ben-Gavir entering the Knesset, who are Kahana's students. They call for the death of the Arabs and for the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and they call for all the racist slogans that the Zionist entity has never reached before. Here they are on the Knesset seats and on the seats of active ministries in the government. They control the heartbeat of the Palestinian people, not only in the occupied interior, but also in the West Bank. Therefore, this turmoil will undoubtedly be reflected in the development of events in Jenin, Nablus and the West Bank, so that the clash continues and we may even witness a boiling state in the coming months when this unprecedented fascist camp in the history of this entity takes over the military and security field. Today, the Israeli police, which Ben-Gavir will lead, has a military base in the heart of the Israeli army in the south. This means that Ben-Gavir's Al-Yammam unit and the border guard will be more active in the northern part of the West Bank, igniting the region in a broader way. When the Palestinian martyr Ammar was executed a few days ago in the Hawara accident, the criminal Ben-Gavir tweeted and considered that the killing of Ammar was a blessed operation, even though it was a crime that took place in broad daylight in front of the entire world and was, without any doubt, a cold-blooded execution.
Well, in any case, the recent weeks in the West Bank have laid down a very clear equation based on which the Israeli policy in the future will be against the Palestinian natives, that it will depend on more terrorism, just like operation that you just spoke about right now, the actual execution of a Palestinian in the broad daylight in the streets of occupying Palestine. Will this fact have any implications on the normalizing Arab regimes with the Zionist entity who made the famous or infamous, if I may, Abraham Accord?
The normalizing regimes with the occupation entity have removed all masks from their faces. Recently, the right-wing fascist Zionist parties organized visits to Al-Aqsa Mosque and invited the ambassadors of the countries of the world. The UAE ambassador was actively involved, while the ambassadors of the European Union, for example, abstained. Europe has realized that it is facing a racist political and security development unprecedented in the history of international relations in the region. But the United Arab Emirates, for example, did not realize this. Turkey, in the words of Erdogan, have said that his government congratulated Netanyahu and said that this government is the one that will make peace. Therefore, when we talk about the current countries of normalization, these countries do not care about all these developments inside Palestine. They are countries that look after their own interests, although there are no interests in reality, because there is no real relationship between the Zionist entity and these countries. We have seen the Arab peoples, the Arab teams, and the Arab masses at the World Cup in Qatar. How they celebrated and still celebrated the Palestinian flag and the injustice afflicting Palestine, and we saw how they were all hostile to the Israeli presence that overwhelmed Qatar from one end to the other. Therefore, unfortunately, these countries, including Bahrain, received Herzog after the last elections. These countries support these fascist developments within the Israeli camp. So the Arab nation, whether at the level of the region, the Middle East, and the world as a whole, is facing two sides, and there is no third side. Either you are on the side of the Palestinian people, or you are against them. There is no gray area.
Definitely. Definitely, Mr. Jaradat, there is no gray area when it comes to Palestine. It's either with it or against it, and we know our place very well. We are with the Palestinian people, we are with you, we support you, and we wish you victory against this fascist terrorist entity. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mohammad Jaradat, political commentator and author, for joining us from Jenin to talk about how Jenin is facing this Zionist fascism. And I want to thank you very much for joining us to talk about very pressing and important matters right here in West Asia. Thank you for always listening to what we have to provide to you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream. See you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Will the International Criminal Court begin proceedings against Netanyahu for the crime of apartheid? This question and many others in this regard will be answered in the weeks or months ahead. One thing at least is certain. There will be more pain for Palestinians, even if the Zionist regime supporters, especially the U.S. and its Western and Arab allies, will find it increasingly hard to present a coherent support for the fabricated regime of Israel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, 10 human rights groups based in the occupied territories are urging the International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor to visit Palestine and move forward with the investigation opened by his predecessor last year after a years-long preliminary examination. Karim Khan, the court's chief prosecutor, said earlier this month that he aimed to visit Palestine in 2023. His remark during the court's assembly of state parties came amid criticism that his office has stalled the Palestine investigation despite the rapidly deteriorating human rights situation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In a letter to Khan, the groups based in state that crimes within the tribunal's jurisdiction have been and are being committed. The organizations, which include Adala, a group that advocates for the rights of Palestinians in the occupied territories, and B'Tselem, which has extensive documentation of Israeli regime's violations, pledged to assist the investigation. The groups noted that the Zionist regime has a record of preventing international access to the territories under its control. It has denied entry to UN investigators and staff members, as well as international scholars and human rights advocates, or forced them to leave, the groups state in their letter to Khan. This context makes your visit and the granting of access to your office ever more important, the groups state. Palestinian human rights groups have expressed frustration that Khan hasn't made any progress on the Palestine investigation. Khan has made no public statement denouncing the Zionist regime's terror group designations and raids targeting the offices of Palestinian human rights groups that have submitted evidence files to the court on behalf of victims. During his visit to Al-Quds in July, U.S. President Joe Biden affirmed that Washington would work with Tel Aviv to combat all efforts to boycott or delegitimize Israel, to deny its right to self-defense, or to unfairly single it out in any forum, including at the United Nations or the International Criminal Court. The U.K., which nominated Khan for the chief prosecutor post, similarly opposes the ICC investigation in Palestine. Despite the state's opposition to the investigation, the Zionist regime's new cabinet is taking aim at its best defense against ICC scrutiny. Itamar Ben-Gvir, a far-right lawmaker in Benjamin Netanyahu's new cabinet, is advancing legislation that would provide legal immunity to Israeli forces and police for their actions during security operations. According to Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz, officials are concerned that such a move would make Israeli soldiers susceptible to prosecution by the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Khan's predecessor, Fatou Bensouda, stated in late 2019 that her office's assessment of the scope and genuineness of the Zionist regime's domestic proceedings remains ongoing at this stage. By doing away with its self-investigation mechanism, albeit one dismissed by B'Tselem as a fig leaf for the occupation, the Zionist regime will be greasing the gears in what otherwise would likely be a major sticking point for the investigation. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's leaders appear to be daring the ICC to intervene by pledging to advance annexation of land in the West Bank. A similar promise made by Netanyahu during his electoral campaign in 2019 was noted by concern by Bensouda in her request to a pretrial chamber to confirm the court's territorial jurisdiction in the West Bank and Gaza. That same year, Netanyahu was warned by the Zionist Attorney General that formally annexing West Bank land would be indefensible at the ICC and would leave army officials, settlement leaders, and other Israeli regime personnel vulnerable to investigation by The Hague. Recently, Netanyahu has published its guiding principles, which begin with, the Jewish people have an exclusive and unquestionable right over all areas of the land of Palestine, as they claim. There is little ambiguity regarding the new Zionist regime's cabinet intention to deepen the Zionist colonization of Palestinian and Syrian land and consolidate its apartheid rule in all the territory under its control. Palestinians and international human rights groups, including Amnesty International, have called on Khan to investigate the Zionist regime's apartheid. If Khan heeds those calls, Netanyahu could potentially be the first individual ever prosecuted in an international court for the crime of apartheid. Meanwhile, the website of RT wrote in this regard, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called on world leaders to reject all dealings with the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's new government. The call comes in response to a policy document in which Netanyahu promised to expand Jewish settlements on Palestinian land. According to RT, the Palestinian Foreign Ministry said in a statement recently, the state of Palestine rejects the annexationist, violent, racist, and incitement to ethnic cleansing policy guidelines of Israel's new government, adding that it considers this agenda an existential threat to the Palestinian people and their inalienable and inviolable rights. The international community must carry out its responsibilities and reject any dealings with a government committed to carrying out international crimes, including annexation, political persecution, and racial discrimination, the statement continued.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about banking in this episode and the upcoming episodes, hopefully, or inshallah, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we start our program, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jal, hosting this program, and Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the financial matters, according to the fatwas by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, let me ask you this question, Sheikh Tawid. Is it permissible for the bank officials to pay the profits generated by the very money deposited, in the banks by those customers to any personal legal entity?
Well, I think the question is very general, and it seems to me that there is some kind of ambiguity in the very question that you asked, because now the profit is given to whom? Is it given to the depositor, to the account holder, or to any person or any entity? Okay, that's the question, because what I understood from the question, that's the thing which makes it ambiguous. Now, if it is given to any person, like a poor person or an organization or an entity, I think there should be a procedure, there should be a policy which according to which the bank should act. You know, if the profits are the property of the bank, that's what I want to say. If the profits are the property of the bank, it is up to the bank to deal with the profits according to the procedure in place. So it can, for example, if it makes a profit and then the profit belongs to the bank has the right and has the power to give it to whomever the bank wants to give. But if the profits are the property of the depositors or the account holders, it is at their disposal. It is, you know, it should be given to the account holders. And, you know, sometimes, you know, the bank enters into an agreement with the account holder or with the depositor, and there's a kind of partnership between the depositor and the bank. So therefore, the profit should be at least a portion of the profit, let's say one third of the profit or two third of the profit, mm-hmm. should be given to the account holder or to the depositor, and then the remaining can be owned or taken by the bank itself.
I see. Okay. Another question would be related to basically the kind of interest that people or depositors get from the bank by depositing some money in their own accounts, like some kind of savings account or whatever.
Yes.
You know, banks pay depositors these monthly interest right? This interest is sometimes even fixed, you know, before the money that the account is open, basically, in the banks. So further, the depositor does not bear a loss. Thus, is it permissible to deposit any money for the purpose of, you know, receiving such an interest? Is such a transaction unlawful, religiously speaking, because it's riba-based?
Well, if the money was deposited in the savings account as a loan, while the transaction is based on interest, or it is stipulated at least to get interest, this clearly and understandably, of course, is a riba-based loan, because the deposit was based on interest, and it was stipulated that the bank is supposed to give usury or riba to the account holder. So there is no doubt as to the fact that this transaction is basically a haram. It is illicit. It is unlawful. And the person who receives them, the usury or riba, is not entitled to it. He cannot own the money. And of course, any profit which is made and received through such an agreement is illicit. It's considered to be riba. And of course, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that alternatively, there is no harm in depositing the money with the bank for an investment in a Shari'i contract, because there are many halal transactions,
mm-hmm.
Which can make the profit quite halal, quite lawful. And of course, fixing the rate is also permissible if it is part of a legal and lawful contract. Of course, we have discussed this in the previous episodes, that there are different kinds of transactions and contracts which make it halal for the investor to receive profit. And that is, of course, silent partnership, or that is ju'ala, or maybe rent. The profit that comes from the money which is invested by the bank is obviously haram, if as long as it is used as invested capital by the bank.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away. La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar. Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Mahajad Hotz, in this program, and Sheikh Tawid is still our guest speaker, answering my questions related to financial matters. Sheikh Tawid, if the mukallaf, or duty bound, or legal agent, or whatever you call that individual, was unaware of certain improprieties in certain transactions that are performed, that are done by some bank employees, such as silent partnership and credit sales. Yes. Is it permissible for this individual, this legal agent, to deposit their money with the bank in order to obtain profits?
Well, if the duty-bound person, who you call, of course, mukallaf, is convinced somehow that the bank employees are investing his money in an illegal transaction, of course, it's not permissible for him to either receive the profit and the profit or make use of the profit. He's not allowed to do so because the transaction was basically forbidden. It is, for example, the money, his money was used in something haram, like promoting wine or promoting something haram, like haram music, like selling and buying unlawful things like gambling tools and so on and so forth. So if he comes to know, or if he is convinced that his money was deposited in such areas, then of course he's not entitled to the profit. He cannot receive it. And but it's very difficult to make sure that his money was basically used for these purposes, or it was invested for in a haram transaction, because it's an uphill task to find out that it was basically invested for these purposes.
Yes.
So as long as he's not certain, as long as he does not know that his money was used for something haram, to promote something haram, then of course he can take the profit, and of course he is entitled to the profit, which was agreed as part of a legal and lawful contract.
So what makes that kind of transaction like unlawful? Is it only the kind of transactions which are haram, basically done or executed on the part of the bank, that makes it haram?
Obviously, of course, if a transaction, there are two scenarios.
Yes.
First, maybe the depositor knows that his money is going to be invested or used to promote, like, gambling or wine or an industry.
Which is obviously unlawful.
So this makes the transaction basically unlawful, and the money which is received,
gained,
or the profit which
this,
is gained, is haram.
Yeah.
Now there's another scenario. If, for example, the depositor and the bank enter into a contract based on usury, and there is no actually partnership, there is no silent contract or, you know, silent partnership, or there is no rental or something like that, which make the contract lawful, and the depositing or the money is paid to the bank only based on the transaction, on usury stipulated in the contract, then in that case, of course, the money received by the investor, by the depositor, not investor, because we cannot use the term investor in this case, is going to be unlawful and haram.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, and thank you for joining us and listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim Malja.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran.
You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.